Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris. For the next 2 weeks, our special guest is Harry Dent. Mr. Dent is president of the H.S. Dent Foundation, whose mission is helping people understand change. He's the founder of H.S. Dent, which publishes the H.S. Dent Forecast and oversees the H.S. Dent Financial Advisory Network. He's the author of many books, some of which include The Great Boom Ahead, 1992, The Roaring 2000s, and The Great Depression Ahead that just came out in 2009. Mr. Dent, we welcome you to our show.
Oh, nice to be here.
Before the books, you were on your way to getting an economics degree, and you made a switch to finance and accounting. What was the reason behind the change?
Well, you know, I just found that economics didn't really show much that people could understand, and most economists didn't seem to be able to predict anything. So, yeah, after three courses in my economics major, I talked to my father's friends in business and stuff, and they said, oh, we all wish we'd taken accounting and finance, and it's a better way to learn economics anyway. So I switched to that, and then eventually then went to Harvard Business School and focused in business strategy and marketing and kind of bigger picture stuff. So I pretty much studied business instead of economics.
That probably explains why you come out with different conclusions. Was there an inspirational moment where you looked at something and said, you know what, I never thought I'd put those two pieces together, but that is what the beginning of your methodology. Did it start with one of those aha moments?
Yeah, it did actually once. I mean, I'd been studying demographics in my consulting work, and a lot of long-term trends and stuff, but one day, this was in 1988, I had the S&P 500 adjusted for inflation on one side of my desk, a long-term chart, and I had the birth index, you know, for baby boomers and all that stuff on the other side. And I looked at the two charts and said, gosh, they look exactly alike. I put them together, and on a 45 to 50 year lag, yes, they overlap. And the light bulb went off for me because I knew demographics and knew that the peak in spending was between 45 and 49 for the average family. So I just like, oh my gosh, you know, I can predict the economy 50 years, almost 50 years in advance with one simple indicator. Yeah, well, I mean, we've been already lecturing to business people about, you know, a boom starts when a generation's young, you know, like in the early 80s, and it ends when they, you know, most of them hit their 40s and stuff, but we didn't have anything that accurate and that simple just to lay it out in one graph. So, you know, after that, next year I got a whole correlation with inflation and young people and workforce growth, and then, you know, just on and on and on. We just kept finding more things correlate with demographics. That's when I realized, gosh, this is a new science. I mean, this is a way to predict long-term trends in a way that nobody thinks possible.
I hadn't really intended to ask this question, but is this still an ongoing learning process after 20-some years?
Yeah, you know, it always is. I mean, you know, we extended this to real estate and different segments of our economy and a lot of things, and then ultimately to global markets and other countries. And even recently, I had to revise in the paperback edition of The Great Depression Ahead, we had to revise Chapter 6 because I got some new indications on emerging markets for developed countries like Europe and Australia and Japan, you know, with high standards of living. Yeah, they follow a similar spending wave, a 46-year lag on the birth index. But emerging countries don't have the same leveraged kind of climb and spending that developed countries do. So we found that it was workforce growth and urbanization were two key indicators there. So we, you know, calculate things different for emerging countries, and we just made that change in the last year. So, yeah, we're always getting new insights on how demographics and some other cycles affect our economy.
I would assume that that's exciting but also exhausting. You get to the point where you think you're done, and then you look at one more subject, you can go, hadn't considered that.
Yeah, I really, you know, when in this last book that came out in late 2008, I really thought, okay, yeah, I've gotten, because we added some new cycles, some geopolitical cycles and commodity cycles, and that's very important for emerging countries and things like that. And I felt like, hey, I finally nailed down all the key cycles and got it, you know. And then the next thing I know, I'm looking at emerging countries, and I'm realizing, oh my gosh, urbanization is the most important factor there. And so, yeah, like you say, I'd spend another 3-4 months analyzing all that around the world. And, yeah, every time you think you got it done, there's always something new to add. But I do think we've got pretty complete indicators overall at this point.
To me, that lends a lot of credibility to your work, because if you thought you had it nailed, that probably would be a mistake. So if it's always improving, to me, that's important. That's why I read what you write. Your first book was Our Power to Predict, 1989. What was that book about?
Well, you know, same thing. Back then, we had some of our most important indicators. We had the spending wave, the 46-year lag. I'd come up with that in 1988. In 1989, just before that book was written, I came up with the inflation indicator that allows you, we can forecast workforce growth since entries about age 20 on average, about 22 decades out, so we can see whether inflation is going to be heading up or down based on demographics. And we also had the S-curve in what we call the four-stage business and economic cycle. So those were our most fundamental indicators. And even in that book, we said, hey, you know, the Dow's going to hit 10,000 by the early 2000s, and you know, this boom's going to end after 2007. I mean, you know, a lot of the same forecasts as today. We just have, you know, a lot more indicators at a lot more levels now than we had then. But the book was really the same basic topic. You know, people drive our economy, and demographics on one side, and also the S-curve, new technologies like automobiles in the roaring 20s and internet in recent decades. You know, new technologies come in and accelerate growth through productivity, and when you see those new technologies advance like that, you get bubbles. You get bubbles in the stock market like we had from 1914 to 1929 and in the 1990s in this decade.
Did you mention Japan in that early book?
Yeah, we did. You know, that's when people thought we were crazy. We said Japan's going to, you know, slow while the United States and Europe grow in the decade in the 90s. And people thought, no, I mean, everybody thought back then, if you remember, that Japan was going to take over the world and buy all the real estate in the United States.
Yeah, and to be honest with you, that's an astonishing prediction, because when you made it, Japan was soaring.
Yeah.
So for you to say something to that extent on the negative side, it took a lot of guts. And then
that was very contrary. But the same thing in the early 90s and 92, when the Great Boom Ahead came out, late 92, everybody thought the U.S. had seen its best days, and there were all these books out on the depression of the 1990s and the Great Reckoning and bankruptcy 1995, and we said, no, we're going to have an incredible boom, and guess what? That government deficit's going to disappear and turn into a surplus between 1998 and 2000, which is exactly what happened. And we weren't trying to predict political events. We were just seeing that the economy was going to boom, which would raise government tax revenues, and inflation, because we had our inflation indicator back then, inflation and interest rates would fall, and that would also work to the government's advantage. So, you know, with no attention to politics, we were able to predict a boom nobody saw and the disappearance of what back then seemed to be a horrendous deficit of $450 billion.
I think what's unique about your work is that your ability to predict in both a negative direction and a positive direction. So in 89, you're saying something about an economy that was booming. It's about to turn bad. You're talking about an economy that was, as far as a real estate economy in the 90s, that was a tough time for real estate. But the stock market had already done well, and you were going to say it does a lot more, a lot better. I think it, honestly, I don't know too many authors that go in both directions and use the strength of the words you use. You don't give yourself many outs. You're using boom words and depression words. In other words, you can't really go back and say, well, we had a slight one of those. You really kind of put it all out on the table and say it's going to go in this direction, period.
Yeah, it is true. What I found from looking at other authors and economists is they tend to either be perennially bullish or bearish. There's authors that every time we get a little dead or every time we get a boom, they said, oh, you know, the chicken's going to come home to roost, we're going to have a big downturn. And there's economists like Larry Kudlow and people who, no matter what happens, oh, free market capitalism's great and the markets are going to go up.
Right.
And, you know, that's foolish. You look at history and markets always, they go up and they go down. They go up more often than they go down. But when they go down, most of our major downturns have lasted 12 to 14 years. That's one of our key cycles. These generation cycles tend to be up for about 25 to 27 years and then down for 12 to 14. You see the 29 to 42 was an extended downturn, 68 to 82, and now we're saying, and we said from the beginning, 2008 to 2023 is when we have a extended period of demographic weakness. Just like in Japan, it was, you know, 1990 to 2002, you know, same thing, you know, 13 years. So, I mean, this happens over and over again, and it's kind of like, it's ridiculous in a way. It'd be like, you know, in November saying, oh my gosh, it's getting cold. What went wrong? This happens every 40 years. We get a major downturn, and the government always says, oh, that's all right, we'll turn it around, and then they can't, because they can't fight demographics. When you're in a demographic boom, and the economy slows down like it did in the early 90s or the early 2000s, yeah, government can come in and stimulate, and that stimulus will be spent, because you got a generation that needs to earn and spend and borrow more money. But when they're done, just as Japan found, stimulus just doesn't work. And so we're also saying that not only do we have an extended downturn here, and it's the beginning of a long downturn, but we're saying this stimulus program is going to fail. You know, there's going to be this first round, and the young people buy their cash for clunkers and buy their home with an 8,000 credit, and that's pre-selling, you know, the next few years of sales. And then the baby boomers, who are the larger group of consumers, aren't going to buy houses no matter what you give them, because they're done. The kids have left the nest. They don't need a bigger house, and they don't need a car either, because older people don't drive cars much because they're no longer carting kids around.
You know, I'm going to go back to something that you said. I think it's important, because most of the time people are one theme. But that means that everything they read, they already have a conclusion at the end of it.
Yeah, they're selective. That's right. They'll read the bullish-oriented stuff if they're bullish.
Right, or they'll conclude something bullish out of something that would be obviously negative if they had an open mind. And that makes it very tough to come out with a correct conclusion.
Actually, I'll give you an example. I mean, we've had economists who look at our stuff and say, well, emerging countries have demographics. That'll keep the markets up. I'm like, yeah, but we only export 3% of our whole GDP to all of Asia. How's that going to counter baby boomers? And we have other ones that'll say, yeah, but baby boomers are going to be saving more money. That money's going to go in the stock market, and that's going to keep it up. And I'm like, well, you just don't understand demographics.
You know,
yeah, that's right. They'll find a way to turn it into their bullish thing because they don't want to say the market's going to go down.
And one of the reasons I bring that up is that I got married at 17, and in early 70s, I really wasn't well read on the subject at all. And I read a book Howard Ruff wrote, The Coming Bad Years, and it scared the heck out of me. And you know, I took it as gospel. And one of the things he suggested was that you would be prudent to buy 200 pounds of wheat. And I had two kids, not to be outdone, I bought 1,000 pounds of wheat. And that's a long time ago, 35 years ago. I still have a bag of the wheat just to keep it, to look at it. And what it taught me was it's okay to read, it's okay to appropriately react, but you can't always hook, line, and sinker go for somebody's opinion. And so that was an interesting experience for me. But
and also, it should make sense. I mean, we tell people, yeah, we've got tools that are projectable. I mean, economists don't have tools that project trends 50 years in advance. I mean, demographics is projectable. If a life insurance actuary can tell you when you're going to die on average, they can tell us when you're going to spend on average, and that's what we do. So it should also make sense. Like you say, people have this bias. There's people that always think the world's about to come to an end, and we're going to have a big downturn. They always want to run out and buy gold and wheat and all this stuff and beans and shotgun shells and all this stuff. And they're always saying that. If you listen to them in the 70s, they were saying that. And then after the 80s boom, they'd be saying that. After the 90s boom, and now. And, you know, eventually, if you say that, you're going to be right.
Yeah.
Eventually, the world will fall apart, and you'll be glad you had your gold and your shotgun shells. But we're saying, even in this downturn, with all this deficit spending, gold's not going to go up. It's going to go down, because this is a deflation season, a winter season, as we call it. It's not summer, which we had in the 70s. You get inflation in a period like the 70s, but you don't get it when you have a credit bubble deleveraging. That destroys money and credit.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward to covering that in our second segment, because it's fascinating, because, of course, that's counter to most people's conclusion, which I happen to lean toward your bent. One of the things I was also mentioning is that you have a lot of responsibility just because people are now listening to you. You know, in the early years, if you made an opinion, probably, you know, nobody was paying too much attention. All of a sudden, you end up writing a book that ends up being very accurate. And now you say the next thing. Does it ever weigh on you that, oh, my goodness, somebody's going to actually probably follow this? And, you know, it must weigh something on your shoulders.
No, it always does. And like you say, the more people follow you, the more that's the case. I mean, but, you know, every profession has that. If you're a financial planner and you're doing stuff and you're wrong, it's going to hurt the person. If you're a doctor, you make a mistake, you could kill somebody. So that's even worse. So it's the nature of the beast. And, you know, and we always tell people, you know, you ought to read other people, too. You shouldn't just read us. We have a whole list of authors on our website that we think, you know, and they don't always agree. They tend to be somewhat in line, or they have some part of what they say that we use or we think is correct. But you know, some of those authors may say buy gold, and you know, but you know, people should you know, listen to a number of people and see what really makes sense.
Absolutely. A long-term boom prediction is bound to have some down cycles mixed in. How do you know the difference between a downturn that's an anomaly and one that's the beginning of what could be a depression?
Well, you know, first of all, you know, our assumption all along has been, you know, when we have these big stock crashes, whether it be 87 or minor in 90 or big in 2002, if the demographic trends are still up, then the market's going to go to new highs and the economy's going to come back. So the reason we're saying this time it's different is because the demographic trends now have clearly turned in the other level. Baby boomers are going to be moving more in their 50s and 60s, where they're either saving for retirement or spending down their retirement savings. But either way, they're saving and they're spending less. So that tells us that the government stimulus is not going to work this time. It may work short term, but it's not going to continue to work because you've got people who don't want to spend. So yeah, that's what tells us we've changed direction, and now we're in a longer term bear market. And then, you know, then we have to use technical indicators in the short term to decide, you know, magnitudes of downturns and stuff. And that's actually more difficult. It's easier to predict long trends and approximate turning points than it is to predict exactly how far the market will go down in a turn. Like this past crash, you know, our indicators pretty much said it, you know, the Dow should have stopped around 7,200 at the lowest. Well, it went to 6,440, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so the magnitude of those things is something you have to kind of look at a lot of short-term indicators and see how bullish and bearish investors are in a lot of different ways. And that's a way you can make good guesses there, but that's where we're not as sure we're going to be right when it comes to the short term. You know, we're just going to make the best guess about when a correction is going to start and how far it's going to go.
There's three cycles that I want to talk about. There's an 80-year new economic cycle. What is that, and when did the last one start?
That is actually what we call our four-season model, and we find this throughout everything, science, larger cycles, smaller cycles. It's always spring, summer, fall, winter. There's always four stages, and that's true in business cycles. It's true in human life cycles, all types of things. It's one of those things that's just consistent throughout the universe. And so every other generation, when we put two-generation booms and busts together, we get those four seasons. We had spring boom with the Bob Hope generation, you know, after World War II, 40s, 50s, and 60s, and then they peak out, and from 68 to 82, we had the downturn, which was the summer season, and that summer season saw high prices or inflation. And that's bad for the stock market in addition to a slowing generation spending. And then we came into what we call the fall boom, the 80s, 90s, and this recent decade, and that's when the baby boom generation, even larger generation, was pointing up in spending. So we had a boom, but in this case, we're going from high inflation to lower inflation, and so inflation comes down. So you get disinflation, lower interest rates, and that's really good for the stock market. The stock market loves not just spending and earnings, but it loves falling interest rates, and that's also causes bubbles. So we always say you get in the fall season is when you see stock market bubbles and real estate and other things. We didn't have bubbles in the 50s and 60s boom, even though it was a great boom. And then, of course, fall, when those credit bubbles and stock and real estate bubbles deflate, when you get the downturn of the baby boom cycle, then you get deflation and you get falling prices, which is winter. So, you know, 26 years up, 12 to 14 years down, boom and bust cycles, and then you get mild inflation, steep inflation, falling inflation, and then deflation. So you've got a four-season, 80-year cycle. That occurs over two generation booms that last about 38 to 40 years each.
And that,
those total cycles. So those two together give you close to 80 years.
And that's repetitive going backwards.
It is, with the exception that, and another thing we found in recent years is that in our lifetime, that's been what the cycle is, because the generation demographics have been so critical to the economy. If you go back to the 1800s and 1700s, particularly in the 1800s when we have better data, we had the same four-season cycle, but it was around two 29- to 30-year commodity cycles, because back then we were an agrarian society, a farming society, and that was the more important indicator. We didn't have these high-paying, healthcare-laden office jobs that we have today that have caused the demographics. You know, we didn't have middle-class consumers that were so powerful in our economy. So the demographics was a what I'd call a recessive cycle, a minor cycle, and the commodity cycle was actually the larger cycle. Now it's flipped the other way. The demographics trumps, and the commodity cycle is less important for a country like the United States. Now, you couldn't say that in Brazil or an emerging country that exports commodities, but for us, commodities are maybe 10% of our economy when we add it all up. So obviously, they're not going to drive the whole engine here.
So
back then it would have been 60-year cycles. That used to be called the Kondratieff wave. And that's what caused a lot of good forecasters from Robert Prechter, James Dale Davidson, and a bunch of others to predict the Depression in the 1990s. If you'd have followed that 60-year cycle, spring, summer, fall, winter, you'd have said, oh, the 80s boom was fall, and now we're due to hit winter in the 90s. And we're looking at demographics saying no chance we're going to have anything but a glorious boom with the largest generation in history moving up their steepest spending curve.
When a prediction turns out to be incorrect, do you have a process to see if it was a faulty original conclusion or something that really was unforeseeable?
Yeah, it's actually more than that. We assume we're missing something. I mean, most people assume the markets just aren't getting it and they'll be vindicated. I mean, we had this because when we look back at this 80-year cycle, and we went back to the early 1900s when autos were going through the same cycle as the Internet and generation cycle back then, we saw a first tech bubble from 1912 to 1919. Very similar to the 90s, and then a big crash in the early 20s, and then you saw another strong bubble in the Roaring 20s. So the Roaring 20s was the second tech bubble. Well, we assumed that was going to happen again. And so coming out of this downturn in 2000, we said, hey, man, no, we're going to go back up to 30, 32,000, 35,000 on the Dow. There's going to be another bubble. And instead, we got a normal boom. The stock market just doubled instead of quadrupled. So 2005 and 6, we were expecting the market to accelerate again, and we saw, this just isn't happening. So I went back and just went back over the last 200 years of data we have and looked for any other cycle, any other thing, and I found two new cycles. I found this commodity cycle. I mean, we'd never seen a boom before in this last century where, I mean, when the economy is booming, usually commodity prices are coming down. Well, no, this was the first time where we had a boom and we had oil prices going to $147. If we'd have known oil was going to $147, we wouldn't have predicted Dow would go to 32,000. We also found an even more important geopolitical cycle where the general market valuations and the general geopolitical environment in the world goes from good to bad, every 17 years. Like 83 to 2000 was gold and everything was great, starting with 9/11, 2001, up till recently. I mean, all we have is trouble in the world. We have one dictator after the next, one war after the next, all this sort of stuff. Well, the same thing happened in the early to mid-60s. All the, everything was hunky-dory in the 50s and early 60s, and then you get the Cuban Missile Crisis, and then Kennedy gets assassinated, and then Martin Luther King, and then the Vietnam War escalates, and then the Cold War. I mean, it just same thing. We get about 17 years of a good environment, and in those environments, stocks have twice as strong valuations when things are good in the world. And that explained why, that we took our Dow forecast from 32,000 down to 16,000 when we brought that cycle in, and that got much closer to the top. So we actually, by assuming we're wrong and assuming we must be missing an important cycle, when things don't add up, when our cycles that we know are good, something comes in, we assume, we must be missing something. In this case, we found two wonderful new cycles.
See, made lemons out of lemonade. That's great. Okay, we're down to 30 seconds, so I'm going to mention your website, hsdent.com. And at that site, you'll find all of his books and other things that his company's involved with. Mr. Dent, we thank you so much for joining us and look forward to our next conversation.
Great. I enjoyed it.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.